this week on COVID, race, and democracy.
These are just simply not safe times for anybody who has the potential to become pregnant in the United States. And it's not just then the policing. One has to be concerned in these states that would seek to coerce people into taking pregnancies to term that the United States has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world. These states are the most dangerous places in the developed world to even be pregnant.
Michelle Goodman, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood, says legislators have turned to criminalizing women for miscarriages, stillbirths, and are threatening the health of their pregnancies.
We will defend our socialism, as we have for 61 years, for Fidel and Raul.
The Cuban people and their international allies celebrate Workers' Day and continue to speak out against the U.S.-imposed embargo of the socialist island.
We know firsthand that when you do public, quote-unquote, public transit for private profit, it's not going to be run well. It's going to be to the public's detriment, and especially to the detriment of the workers out there.
Striking bus drivers in Washington, D.C. fight public transport privatization schemes while struggling to achieve parity with fellow union members who drive directly for D.C. Metro Bus of the Washington Metro Area Transport Authority. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akul Holt. Attorney Michelle Goodwin is the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood, a work that expands the reproductive health and rights debate beyond abortion to include how legislators increasingly turn to criminalizing women for miscarriages, stillbirths, and threatening the health of their pregnancies. Here, she talks to acclaimed filmmaker and activist Michael Moore.
Dr. Goodwin, thank you so much for being part of this. Thank you for writing that essay, and thank you for writing this book, Policing the Womb. Is the nonfiction version, in some sense, of A Handmaid's Tale. Thank you for what you've done, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for lifting up these important issues and bringing them to your audience.
Well, we have to, because I get the sense that we are just months, weeks away from our new Supreme Court, one-third appointed by Donald Trump, of declaring that the government is going to say what women can do with their reproductive organs, with their bodies, and that Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case that essentially made it legal for women to be able to choose whether or not they wanted to have a baby, that is possibly going to be overturned or restructured in some other way to the point where women are going to lose this right. Do I have that right, or
You're right in that. So the case before the United States Supreme Court comes out of Mississippi. It's the Dobbs case, and it's a case that involves a 15-week abortion ban that provides no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. This is a modern feature of the anti-abortion campaigning, something that we wouldn't have seen a decade ago. We wouldn't have seen 5 years ago. We wouldn't have seen pre-Trump. Now, the state, with this new composition on the Supreme Court, has sought not only its 15-week abortion ban because of the current composition of the court, it has asked the court to do away with Roe v. Wade altogether.
Is that going to happen?
Many people are saying that we should prepare for that to happen because the Supreme Court has a very vocal majority that has articulated both in terms of personal leanings and also prior adjudications that they have no sympathy towards Roe v. Wade or reproductive rights generally. And Chief Justice John Roberts, who very recently has been siding with liberals on the court, his vote no longer matters to that five-justice majority that has shown a lack of regard for Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and the various laws that have protected reproductive rights.
Is there a chance that one of those five will have an epiphany before June and the court won't get rid of Roe v. Wade?
This is a really good question. So over time, there are those of us who've said that it's been a death by a thousand strikes. This kind of movement that we saw speed up come 2010. So between 2010 and 2013, there were more anti-abortion, anti-contraception laws that were proposed and enacted than the 30 years prior combined. And the important point to note there is that this was with the rise of the Tea Party. And it's important to understand that this movement is not only one that seeks to trample and seeks to get rid of, if you will, reproductive rights, but this is a movement that is also behind voter suppression, gerrymandering, all of that. It's all a part of a narrative of a kind of America of Jim Crow, an America that was, you know, pre-13th Amendment is what these people have the taste for. And to put that in context, Roe v. Wade was a 1973 opinion, and it was 7-2, the votes in that case. Mm-hmm. Five of those seven justices were Republican appointed.
Wasn't the opinion, the actual opinion itself, written by one of the Republican appointed?
That's right. You're absolutely right, Michael, by Justice Blackmun, who was put on the court by Richard Nixon.
Right.
The father of George H.W. Bush, Prescott Bush, was the treasurer of Planned Parenthood.
Wow.
So what we see these days that parades itself as Republican, it's important to note that it is not the kind of traditional Republican values. This is more of a kind of Tea Party mix with evangelicism that is not part of the Republican tradition. That at least was the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, but as part of this very mean-spirited wave that we've seen, which is not too distant from seeing children being locked in cages and having the federal government argue against providing them soap and toothpaste.
For the people who are listening to this, what can they do? What can we all do between now and, let's say, when they release their judgment here in June, maybe July, maybe May? It's not far off here.
No.
And I think, you know, there's so much going on in the world, obviously, with the pandemic that we're still in the middle of, the war in Ukraine, so many things. And I think that there's a lack of focus amongst people that maybe we should be talking about this more, and maybe we should get ready. And what, if anything, can we do to encourage the court to do the right thing?
So there are a number of things to do right now. One happens to be supporting funds, abortion funds, that help people to be able to have the means to go out of state and get the healthcare services that they need. Because it's important that people remember that there are people who need abortions to save their lives, to manage miscarriages, and of course, to remember that it is a constitutionally protected right. It's important at the state level to contact state legislators in states where there are trigger laws that may go into effect, such that if the Supreme Court upholds the Mississippi law, then there are over two dozen states that have ready to go similar laws. And it's important that in those states, they understand that voters are opposed to those kinds of laws. And then I think that they really need to be prepared for what I call the new Jane Crow, which is newer forms of surveillance, of policing, of criminalizing women and girls as they seek reproductive health care. And this may have nothing to do with abortion. I mean, the kind of policing of people who want to carry pregnancies to term, but who maybe used marijuana to calm their nerves before labor, or used a Valium to calm their nerves before labor. The policing of those women, because we've already begun to see those kind of arrests taking place. These are just simply not safe times for anybody who has the potential to become pregnant in the United States. And it's not just then the policing. One has to be concerned in these states that would seek to coerce people into taking pregnancies to term that the United States has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world. These states are the most dangerous places in the developed world to even be pregnant. So there's a lot to pay attention to in these spaces.
Dr. Michelle Goodwin, in conversation with filmmaker Michael Moore about her book, which deals with the painful topic of how policing women's bodies has led to the United States being the deadliest country in the developed world for pregnant women.
Women should be a priority, respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority figures, like the media that trashes us, play down the hype that constantly bashes our image. TV movies and the videos use women's bodies to create a sick sideshow, too many times seen as a sex symbol, no real intelligence, just a brainless bimbo, not taken seriously for who she needs to be, a human being with the right to be free. Not misinterpreted so much of the time. A no means yes, only in a man's mind. Women who struggle and shout, take back the night, are often viewed by others in the wrong light. The daily violence of rape, don't misconstrue. It is a fact of life, and it could happen to you. You could be walking down the street, a gang of miscreants you happen to meet, high on drugs or whatever the case. They pull a knife or hold a gun to your face. You cry, yo, 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 can't you see I'm a man? But they just laugh and get down with their funky scams. You left and wonder, can I still call myself a man? Maybe the plight of women you can now understand. And check our history, correctly line and define our identity. No more distortion, hear but in a true proportion. Erase the guise of lies that had you dissing me. Check for our past and what we gave humanity. Life from the womb of creation was born the earth, the mother of all habitation. And from her loins the beginning population. Some call her Eve, others call her Lucy. Some try to blame her for the problems of society. But since we know that it was men who wrote the books, perhaps we need to re-examine, take another look. Look into Africa, the black land they call Al-Kabla. Here is a story, the teachers of our former glory, of queens and warriors, women strong and brave, refused to be subdued or taught how to behave. They clearly understood the power within comes from God and should not be dictated by men. Some ruled their nation seated on a throne. Some led in battle, fighting to protect their home. Some studied nature, the sciences of healing. Religion and the arts reflect their deepest feeling. Music, the list is practically endless. The contributions we have made are quite timeless. In almost every category you will find us singing or playing instruments. Upon the world we make our mark, we make a serious dent. We have influence of sound. We offer soul that nowhere else can be found. Touching of feelings that are rich and profound. Words, let's talk about some writers who use the pen and pages, weapons of a fighter. Educating through their poetry and prose, their essays and the novels and the stories that drove a message with a rhythmical spear into our conscious minds to make us adhere to life and its reality. Uncovering the clouds of mystery.
Sweet Honey in the Rock. Women should be a priority from the album In This Land. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Pascal Robert, co-host of This Is Revolution podcast, spoke to Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly about the recent news that the Supreme Court plans to overturn the Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion.
Part of the problem we as leftists or radicals or militants, whatever term you want to use, those who challenge the system, have in our analysis of the Supreme Court, is that we are caught in the fog of believing that the Supreme Court was a long-term progressive institution. This is something that must be stated, and it's very important for our listeners to understand. The period of time in which the Supreme Court has this charade of progressivism is basically starting with the Brown v. Board period and the civil rights cases that start in the 30s and 40s and ends pretty much in the 60s and early 70s with Roe v. Wade. Within 2 or 3 years of Roe v. Wade, you have the Bakke case, which reverses affirmative action. What I'm trying to explain to people is that the belief that the Supreme Court is some kind of bastion of freedom, that it should be cherished by anyone who cares about protecting the rights of citizens in this country, is a charade. Before the progressive period that starts in the World War II era, that takes the court in this direction, we were in what's called the Lochner era of the Supreme Court. Lochner was a Supreme Court case that basically let corporate finance and corporations in this country defy monopoly rights and just go buck wild for decades. The Supreme Court is also the Supreme Court of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 that codified Jim Crow, of Dred Scott in the 1850s that codified denying black people citizens. The Supreme Court has only been a friend of black people in this country for the politics of Cold War politics in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s, because with the rise of Nazism and the rise of World War II and the rise of the Soviet Union, it was realpolitik crucial for the United States to have the court pivot in a way that made it look like a more humane steward of the lives of minority communities in comparison, particularly with the Soviet Union. Rip this notion that the Supreme Court is a bastion of liberty and justice for all out of our minds and realize this is by definition and by structural makeup a reactionary, hardcore reactionary, preservationist institution. Preservationist meaning that it preserves the systems of capitalism and imperialism that disproportionately affect black and brown communities adversely. It preserves white supremacy. So that was something I wanted to get forth, is to put the Supreme Court in that proper historical context. What is happening now today, for me, in terms of the Supreme Court echoing that it will overturn Roe v. Wade, does not surprise me, basically realizing that in the period of what we at This Is Revolution podcast call the 50-year counter-revolution. What is a 50-year counter-revolution? The theory we have is that starting in 1968, which was the year I was born, all of American politics, both Democrat and Republican, is a counter-revolution against the radical movements of the 60s, Black Power, and all of the counter-hegemonic forces that came through that time, with a bipartisan consensus that pivots to neoliberal privatization and capitalism, that pivots to a mass incarceration state, and that pivots to a hardcore police militarization state and a delegitimizing of rights that were won within that civil rights, long civil rights period that some would argue either starts in the 50s or goes back to the 30s. And one of the facets of this 50-year plus counter-revolution is that the Supreme Court has been used as a bulwark, as a bat against progressive rights assertions going back to Nixon's appointment of Rehnquist, and consisting on even Democrats nominating very, very milquetoast, middle-of-the-road nominees. So it does not surprise me that after Trump's election, that he gets the picks that he does that solidify a 6-3 majority of conservatives. In terms of the right-wing makeup of the court, as well as the religious makeup of some of its members, it doesn't surprise me that they're doing this. What is quite disingenuous to me is the fact that the Democratic Party is acting like it's been in opposition to this tendency when Hillary Clinton, in her 2016 election bid, chose Tim Kaine as a vice presidential running mate who was outwardly anti-abortion, who's a pro-life guy. When you have Nancy Pelosi up until May of last year campaigning for pro-life Democrats, we have quotes and publications of Nancy Pelosi saying how abortion is a problem for the Democratic Party because it forces us to have to defend pro-choice. Abortion is weakness for Clinton's EP favorite. This is from The Hill from June 2016. Hillary Clinton says, of course you can be a feminist and be pro-life. This is from April 5th, 2016, from ABC News. I mean, I can go on with the screenshot. Nancy Pelosi says Democrats' focus on abortion access is hurting the party. This is from May 3rd, 2017. All right? So what is interesting to me is now the Democrats are going to play that ridiculous con game, is that, oh, if you leftists had only voted for Hillary, we wouldn't have these problems. I think that's a load of crap because, number one, even if Hillary Clinton had won that election, that doesn't guarantee that either a Supreme Court slot would have opened, even if it did, that the court position right now would have pivoted in a way that obscures the 5-4 situation we have. Even if it did, that being the case, eventually the tides of the court were going to turn in a direction where this subject would come up. Because the legal foundation of Roe v. Wade is on a kind of, I mean, I believe in a woman's right to choose, ideologically without a question, but it's based on a legal argument that creates rights out of an argument within the actual language of the decision. And that's why it's been so shaky and easy to be picked away at, because the thing that gives people the right to have an abortion is not actually a right in the Constitution. It's an interpretation of rights that the Supreme Court said in Roe versus Wade come from the emanations and penumbras. What the heck? An emanation and penumbra is like smoke. It's like something you just pull out of the air. The emanations and penumbras of the Constitution is what gives people the rights of privacy. I am a firm believer in the right of privacy as a moral, spiritual, and legal right. But it, my rights don't come from the Supreme Court. They come from my own understanding of what humanity should demand for its living condition. But the Supreme Court interpreted a right to privacy out of the emanations and penumbras of the Constitution. And it's that kind of weak framing that allows them to do what they did recently this week.
That was Pascal Robert, co-host of This Is Revolution podcast and a contributor to the Black Agenda Report and Newsweek, speaking to Margaret Kimberly, host of Black Agenda Radio. Classic by John Klimmer, Touch. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Eritrea's national health system has been remarkably successful at eradicating communicable diseases, including HIV. It was the first African nation to meet all the UN's Millennial Development Goals regarding health. Much of its success at eradicating communicable disease has been due to vaccination, especially childhood vaccination. But it has thus far chosen not to institute mass vaccination for COVID-19. COVID Race and Democracy's Anne Garrison has more from on the ground in Asmara, Eritrea.
Eritrea has been criticized for not yet instituting mass vaccination against COVID-19, but thanks to preventive measures, it has sustained a remarkably low rate of COVID infection and death, 9,734 cases and 103 deaths in a population of 3.6 million. PCR tests are required for entry, and masks are widely worn in urban areas. I spoke to Eritrean Minister of Information, Yamani Gebremeskel. You're part of the National COVID Task Force, and the task force has chosen not to institute a mass COVID vaccination program, but you've nevertheless sustained a very low rate of COVID infection and death. Could you explain the decision not to institute the mass vaccination program?
We're not talking about a categorical or unequivocal decision not to introduce vaccination, but I think when the pandemic broke out, I think patient zero here was somebody who came from abroad in March 2020. Uh-huh. And the first thing that was done was to look at what's called a two-track approach. One, preventive measures,
right.
Mandatory masks, physical distancing, disinfectant, right. And so on and so forth. And in fact, originally, I think it was decided for 3 months, but we had a partial lockdown that was extended for almost 6 months. It was partial lockdown because all the agricultural activities were not affected, because mostly they are in the open and they are smaller units, so you don't have huge crowds. So the transmission rate should not be huge. That was the assumption. The industrial sector was not also affected, but all public institutions were closed. All the public services, hotels, restaurants, all that was closed. So that was that went on for only 6 months. The government also pursued a very aggressive policy, because we have a very porous border, and when people coming back from Ethiopia, from the Sudan, at one point in time, flights were also banned. But when people came through aircraft, we had, of course, the testing and so on and so forth at the entry point. But for people who came through land routes, there were extensive quarantine centers. And so I think the preventive measures worked well. I remember at one point it was random testing in Asmara for about 5,000 residents from all the areas, heavily populated, densely populated areas, and so on and so forth. So to give a full picture, and there was only one person, and of course his wife, two people who tested positive. So the positivity rate became low. The case fatality rate, at least the figures we have, also they were low.
103.
Now, even when people are vaccinated, even when they have had boosters, they are getting affected. So one big issue is if the natural immunity gives you the same.
Or better.
even if it's the same, people say with natural immunity, you can affect others, but you will not be affected for 5-6 months. So it's not a closed case, but I think at the moment, there is not also an urgency to push the ministry.
To push mass vaccination.
You have to watch the situation closely. When necessary, you can do it. So it's not philosophical or ideological. It's really the reality. You have to monitor the situation and you calibrate your response.
In Asmara, Eritrea, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
The growing economic collapse in South Africa has escalated with the war in Ukraine and the rising price of basic food supplies. The privatization of the public sector has also been a disaster for the workers and the economy. According to Mehmet Wisebe, president of the General Industrial Workers of South Africa, he was interviewed prior to May Day by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the economy and also the plight of 5,000 striking Clover Dairy workers. They work for the largest dairy company in South Africa, and their company was taken over by the billionaire Israeli Wortham family, which has the license to Coca-Cola in Israel and also has dairies on Palestinian lands. They have also closed many plants and want to import dairy products from Israel to South Africa.
Thank you very much, Comrade Steve, and thank you to comrades in the U.S. and across the world that have stood with us and have continued to support us in the strike against Clover, but also in many other struggles happening here. Of course, the strike now is in its 6 months. Obviously, that's an extremely long period, and I think, as we can imagine, that the situation is extremely complicated with workers not having been any for that long. It is very clear that for geopolitical considerations, the company is not going to back down, even when the strike, from an economic point of view, doesn't make sense for them to dig their heels as they have. I think the fear, more than just the workers of Clover, is united, international solidarity of the working class, that if we win against Zionist imperialism in Clover, it would set an example of how the working class in solidarity with the people of Palestine can defeat Zionist investments across the world. And I think for that reason, their shareholders are willing to bankroll the company to the tune of billions without an end to wear out the workers and so on. As for the union, we are clear we are not going to sign that rotten deal that they have on the table. But of course, we have had to, we are re-evaluating our tactics. whether we shouldn't allow sections of the workers back so that we, you know, get a breathing space in order to re-energize, in order to regain our fighting capacity to continue the war that is certainly going to be a very prolonged one. Of course, that is under discussions between, you know, ourselves as leadership of the union and the workers. And I think there's an openness to that, where we say to workers, maybe you can, as individuals, take what is on the offer and the union officials remain on a strike so that we are able then to continue. And when the opportunity allows to escalate through a series of actions that we are contemplating. In terms of the general political situation in the country, it is a very complicated conjuncture. I think that's the only way to characterize the phase that we are passing through. Because what are we dealing with? We are dealing with a march, on the one hand, of a counter-revolutionary undercurrent of xenophobia that has always been there. And I think from time to time, rear its ugly head. And we've seen that taking more organized form in what is now called Operation Dudula, in a way that we have not seen before. And I think that this Operation Dudula, in my view, represents the bigger threat to the organized working class than any other thing, because what the conditions that gives rise to, and what are those conditions? The deepening levels of unemployment, the deepening levels of poverty, and of course now the deepening crisis of climate change, which manifested itself in the most bloodiest fashion in Durban, where almost 400 lives have been lost and many more are missing. And of course, a catastrophic devastation in terms of infrastructure that is going to take us years, if not decades, to be able to rebuild. I mean, houses, roads, public facilities, like schools, clinics, and all the things and so on have all been washed away in that flood and so on. And of course, there is just a collapse of society at all levels, because obviously the crisis in the economy necessarily translates into crisis at all levels of society, at the level of the family, because, I mean, already we see the astronomical levels of gender-based violence. I was also looking at the statistics released by Statistics South Africa, and it says that only about 31% of Black fathers are there in the lives of their children. And I think that speaks to the intensity of the crisis, that when millions and millions of fathers, of mothers are retrenched, that tears, you know, families apart, and that tears the whole fabric of society apart. And I think xenophobia, gender-based violence, and violence between sections of the working class is a manifestation of that deepening crisis. At a political level, the ruling class has no solutions. The ANC, which is the ruling party, is, you know, in a bloody factional war, because there's no any other way really of describing the state of war or the state of factional politics within the ANC. Each and every week, when you read the newspapers, when you read the, you know, when you look at the news, there's some member of the ANC killed by others in during the meetings and so on. And it's just really a bloody factional civil war between different gangsters of the political elite, fighting over the loot, fighting over the plunder, and access to power that they use for their own enrichment, and of course for the advancement of various sections of the capitalist class that they represent. So that is the situation, but that none of the political parties have no solution is reflected in the fact that they've also jumped on the bandwagon, I mean, of Operation Dudula, of the xenophobic movement. Because one day feature of this current wave of xenophobic mobs and violence is that it has had a support of almost all the mainstream parties, from the ruling ANC to Patriotic Alliance, Action South Africa, but also sections of the DA, which is a white liberal party. I mean, the Action 8 itself is a split from that party. It was only after the leader split from them that they tried to distance themselves from xenophobia. The EFF that itself has by and large condemned the Operation Dudula itself has engaged in acts of xenophobia, going to restaurants and other industries that are seen to be employing more migrants, saying that they are looking for papers, saying that they are asking employers, why are they employing more migrants than locals? So they are capitulating to the mood But the unfortunate thing also is that the same sentiment or the same pressures have been exerted on the labor movement, that sections of the leadership of the labor movement thinks, well, if you are seen to be reasonable in terms of accommodating some of what they consider to be very genuine issues that have been raised by these reactionaries on the issues of violence, on the issues of jobs, you can be able to win the best of them, if we can use that language, over when, in fact, you simply legitimize them. And in any event, you don't answer the questions around the deepening levels of unemployment, the deepening poverty of the working class, which affect even those that are currently employed. And I mean, the thing about that is that the lowering conditions of employment and the brutalization of the working class in this period would only be aided by disenfranchisement of the vast sections of the working class. I mean, the capitalist, you can never give a capitalist a better gift than workers without rights. And when you strip migrants of their rights, that's exactly what you do. You render them, you hand them over to the most ruthless forms of exploitation that would only aggravate even further the brutalization of the rest of the working class. So that overall is a situation, and I think that is a character and the main features of the period that we are passing through, Steve, in South Africa.
That was Mehmet Wisebe, president of the General Industrial Workers Union of South Africa, speaking with Pacifica Steve Zeltzer.
There's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi. There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique. From Lesotho, from Botswana, from Swaziland. From all the hinterlands of southern and central Africa, this train carries young and old African men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropoli. 16 hours or more a day for almost no pay. Deep, deep, deep down in the belly of the earth, when they are digging and drilling for that shiny, mighty, evasive stone, or when they dish that mishmash mash food into their iron plates with the iron shovel. Or when they sit in their stinky, funky, filthy, flea-ridden barracks and hostels, and they think about the loved ones they may never see again, because they might already have been forcibly removed from where they last left them, or wantonly murdered in the dead of night by roving and marauding gangs of no particular origin. We are told. They think about their lands and their herds that were taken away from them with the gun and the bomb and the tear gas and the Gatling and the cannon. And when they hear that choo-choo train, a chugging and a pumping and a smoking and a pushing and a pumping, crying and a steaming and a chicken and a whoop whoop, they always curse and they curse the coal train. The coal train that brought them to Johannesburg. Woo, woo!
The late, great Hugh Masekela, Stimela, The Coal Train. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akul Holt. Workers around the world celebrated Workers' Day on May 1st. Esther Iverum, producer and host of On the Ground, was in Cuba for this celebration. Here's her report.
You have to head out very early, long before daybreak in Havana, to make it to Plaza of the Revolution for May Day. On the way, you see groups of people walking the same direction, carrying banners and signs honoring Cuba's revolutionary leaders, or proudly identifying their own career and work in a hospital or school or hotel or on a farm. Because this day, unlike any day in the United States, powerfully honors workers as the foundation of this socialist economy, which has been battered by 2 years of the pandemic, 243 U.S. economic coercive measures placed on the island by the Trump administration and continued under Biden. And those, of course, are on top of the illegal 60-year U.S. economic blockade. Speaking from a grand reviewing stand, Ulises Guillarte de Nacimiento, General Secretary of the Cuban Workers Federation, which sponsors Labor Day, reflected on this defiance, perseverance, and hope as he told the crowd, quote, "Hostility is growing and the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed on us by the United States government, the main obstacle to our development programs, is intensifying to the extreme. Together with a pandemic that maintains negative impacts in the economic, social, and labor spheres, faced with this panorama, Cuba does not stop. It implements policies to strengthen its economic actors and primary sectors of its productive base, the comprehensive transformation of its neighborhoods, and the reduction of people in situations of vulnerability.
We will defend our socialism, as we have for 61 years, for Fidel and Raul.
Por la continuidad, por las más jóvenes generaciones, por la patria, vamos con todo. ¡Viva el Día Internacional de los Trabajadores! ¡Viva! ¡Hasta la victoria siempre!
I speak to more of the 1,000 solidarity activists who traveled from around the world to be in Cuba, including activists from countries that are indebted to Cuba's acts of heroism during their past or ongoing struggles against U.S. imperialism.
My name is Gabriel Aguirre. I'm from Venezuela. I think that is very important because the May Day memes the struggle of the people of Cuba for the sovereignty, for the independence, for the self-determination. And of course, especially at this time, we are here sharing and supporting to Cuba because we think it's important the end of the blockade and of course the overcome all the sanctions against the people of Cuba.
My name is Mr. Ramugumo Skinja Rozani from South Africa. We are from the Brigade, Friends of Cuban Society, a friendship with Cuba Society in South Africa. But also, over and above, I'm the leader of the South African Communist Party.
So why was it important to come to Cuba to celebrate May Day?
Firstly, let me tell you that when we were busy with our struggles, the first country to come into our assistance was Cuba. And they help us with little resources which they have. And now Cuba is under attack on the imperialist agenda of the USA. So we are here to support in solidarity with the Cuba.
Yeah.
So we won't desert Cuba at all times as South Africans. We will be always with Cuba.
Right.
Against the blockade, inhuman blockade by the American regime.
Right. Yeah. This is a celebration for labor and workers. So what are some of the labor struggles in South Africa?
We are still struggling because, remember, the imperialist forces, the capitalist agenda is entrenched all over the world. And those systems oppress the workers. So we are always organizing workers against the system of capitalism, hoping that one day we'll have a system of socialism where everybody will be free and have a just society.
Camille Landry, and I'm from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
And what made you come out to celebrate May Day in Cuba?
May Day is something worth celebrating. May Day is talking about the glory, the power, the history, the importance, the fundamental nature of the relationship of labor to the society. May Day in Cuba represents justice for the people who create the wealth, who make the society go every day, who make the gears turn. You know, the people who rock the cradles and sweep the streets and invent the new medicines and care for the elderly and the young and build the buildings and make clean water happen and all the other things without which literally civilization could not exist. But in so many other places, laborers are an afterthought at best. Labor is something to be exploited, not something to be glorified, not something to be respected, not something to yield leadership to. Because to yield leadership to laborers is for the people to actually have power.
My name is Alexandre. I'm from Quebec.
So tell me why you came out to celebrate May Day in Cuba.
Because the fight for labor for Cuba. Cuba is being attacked by the U.S. government with the blockade, sanctions, and there are calls for drone strikes in Miami by the Cuban Miami community, the traitors. And we are here to support this example, the Cuban example of revolution, of how we can arrange society to empower and for the betterment of the common people, the workers. That's why we are here in solidarity.
Yeah. So, what are some of the labor struggles happening in Canada?
We had in the last years, we had problems with healthcare. In Quebec, healthcare is in a very difficult situation. People are, their wages are not going up as they should. They are doing extreme hours. But also we had problems with trains, we had problems with agriculture. So it's just the compounded problems of capitalist methods of organizing the production that we are seeing in Canada. That is also happening in the US and in Europe. It's just the same problem, the same anarchy in the organization of production and the impoverishment of the population because these means of production are not organized by the working class.
And those were our voices speaking out on the Plaza of the Revolution in Havana, Cuba on May Day.
That was Esther Iveron, producer and host of On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. In the next segment, striking bus drivers in Washington, D.C. fight public transport privatization schemes while struggling to achieve parity with fellow union members who drive directly for D.C. Metro Bus of the Washington Metro Area Transport Authority. Thomas O'Rourke, our CRD producer in Washington, visited the picket line of the D.C. Circulator Drivers, members of Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 689, striking against management company RATP Development USA, and filed this report.
I spoke to striking drivers of the DC Circulator bus line, some of their union comrades, and to ATU Local 689 spokesman Brian Wyvell on the picket line last Thursday, less than a day before the union and company announced an agreement to a new contract.
You name a government service, there are people out there trying to make a profit off of it instead of providing good public jobs and, good public services. This is absolutely just one more step in what we've been doing over the last couple of years. Local 689 is fully committed to the idea of public transit as something that should be run for the good of the people, to take public yeah. money and turn it for profit. We are fully committed to that idea, and we understand that the only way we're going to get solid, good public services is when they are run by the public for the public benefit. And, you know, we were out there, not only a couple of years ago at Cinderbed Road on strike there against WMATA's efforts to privatize a metro bus garage. We won there after 85-day long strike, and I'm proud to say that every single one of those workers is now a worker at WMATA that is going to be retiring with good wages and benefits and can count on that as a career job. And we view this DC circulator fight as just one more step in that larger picture fight of making sure that every transit worker in this region has good wages and benefits. And part of the way we do that is by making sure that these private contractors have to play by the same rules as all the other transit systems in this region. It has been a struggle for this union to make sure that they keep up with the other transit systems in this region. Originally, when the circulator was first introduced, 689, I believe, might have even supported it at that time because we were under the impression that it was going to be a supplemental bus service to WMATA run express routes downtown. And that is something Local 689 is fully in support of public transit and the expansion of public transit. If we take climate change seriously, we need to do, we need to dramatically expand the amount of public transit we're doing.
Sure.
But we know firsthand that when you do public, quote unquote, public transit for private profit, it's not going to be run well. It's going to be to the public's detriment, and especially to the detriment to the workers out there.
We're talking about equal pay. You know, we trying to survive just like everybody else. And the way that these guys been playing hardball with us, we went to the table yesterday, and hopefully we can get some signed tonight.
By equal pay, you mean equal with Metro drivers?
Yes.
And parity with them.
Yes. That's because we're part of the same union. They're going to definitely shoot for the same thing that they get. We ran through the pandemic. We constantly ran during the pandemic, nonstop. You know, we had drivers here that passed away during that. And just thinking about
it. No hazard pay.
No hazard pay at all. The buses, they break down on the road because they're not buying the parts to fix the buses. So we out there, we got to move the buses out the yard. You know, and it's like they've been getting millions of dollars a year since they've been here. But they're not sharing it with us.
We're hoping to accomplish was to bring the circulator operators up in parity with those of us who work at WMATA, who are part of the same local. We're driving the same buses, we're doing the same work. The only difference between my bus and their bus is the paint job. The only difference between my uniform and their uniform is the color. We're driving on the same streets, we're picking up the same passengers. Their bus fare is $1, mine is $2. But we all deserve to make enough money to be able to support our families and hopefully retire one.
So you're a Metro driver.
That's correct.
Okay. How long have you been a Metro driver?
Almost 16 years.
Almost 16 years. So you are out here in the same union in solidarity with these striking brothers and sisters.
That's correct.
Excellent. That's great.
I'm 20 years in service with the Authority of Metro as well. I'm a mechanic. Just because I'm a mechanic and not an actual bus operator, we still have the same units here. We are in the same fight, and we will prevail as we always do.
The following day, the Washington Post reported that a large majority of striking drivers of the D.C. Circulator bus line had approved a new 3-year contract and thus end a 3-day strike that shut down the privatized supplemental bus service at the onset of summer tourism season here in Washington. The announced settlement seems to make great strides to achieving parity between drivers of the circulator lines and D.C. Metro bus, including raising the starting wage almost $6 to $24.50 per hour. Metro drivers currently start at $25.51 hourly, according to the Post. The deal also raises pay for all drivers some 18.5% over 3 years. The company early last week was only offering 6% over 3 years. Other concessions to the union bargainers include a PPO health insurance option, 4% employer contributions to 401k pensions without employees having to match, a new holiday, and a cap on split runs or split shifts for drivers. For COVID Race and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke in Washington.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. we thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Paulina Vasiliev, Steve Zeltzer, and Akua Holt. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.